From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, it's time for Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. Construction on a $1.8 billion pilot plant at the Bluegrass Army Depot is 75% complete. Starting in the year 2020, that plant will begin rendering chemical weapons in the depot harmless, and that process is expected to be finished in 2023. On today's show, chemical weapons, the Bluegrass Army Depot, and the safety of the communities around this 14,000-acre facility. We'll be interested in hearing from you during today's program. Send us an email to wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send us a tweet. You may need to follow us first at WEKUEST, then send us a direct message or post on our Facebook page. In a few minutes, we'll open the phone lines as well. With us in the studio for today's program, first up, Doug Omachinsky, Bechtel Parsons Bluegrass Project Manager. Doug is involved in leading the joint venture system, or he's leading the joint venture system, the contracting for designing, constructing, testing, operating, and closing the Bluegrass Chemical Agent Destruction Pilot Plant. Doug, thank you for being with us this morning.
Good morning, John.
Jeff Brubaker is a federal government employee with the Department of the Army. He's the Assembled Chemical Weapons Alternatives Site Manager. Jeff is responsible for overseeing the project to construct, systemize, operate, and close the plant that will destroy the chemical weapons at the Bluegrass Army Depot. Jeff, thank you for being with us.
Good morning, John.
Also with us, we have Craig Williams. He's a Vietnam War veteran, founder, former executive director of the Kentucky Environmental Foundation, director of the Chemical Weapons Working Group, and today in the capacity of co-chair for the Chemical Destruction Community Advisory Board. Craig, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And we will also hear from the Madison County Emergency Management Agency. Michael Bryant will be with us later in the program. Doug Omachinsky, actually, and Jeff Brubaker, let's start with Jeff, actually, regarding the Bluegrass Army Depot and its history. We've said it's been housing chemical weapons since the 1940s, the era around World War II. What's the history of that facility?
At the depot, chemical weapons first began to arrive in 1944. That was a couple of years after the depot was actually brought into existence. The depot has always served the U.S. Army and the United States as a weapons storage and transportation center. But in terms of the chemical weapons, the first chemical weapons to arrive in 1944 were mustard-filled artillery projectiles. And then in the 1960s, several types of nerve agent-filled munitions arrived at the depot. There are two types of nerve agent stored at Bluegrass. One is GB, sometimes referred to as sarin, and the second nerve agent is VX. Those nerve agents are stored in either artillery projectiles or what is referred to as M55 rockets.
And this stuff was all designed by the U.S. government for the purpose of potential chemical warfare use?
That's correct. Since actually World War I, that is when the U.S. Army first began to study the deployment of chemical weapons in warfare, and then obviously ramping up for World War II, there was a large production of chemical agents, primarily blister agents such as mustard. And then later in the 1950s and 60s, that was when production of nerve agents became the primary agents that were produced.
Am I correct that the 2% of the nation's stockpile is what is housed at the Bluegrass Depot?
That's correct, and that is measured against the total declared quantity under what's called the Chemical Weapons Convention. That's a international treaty that some 190 nations have signed. Part of that treaty requires destruction of existing chemical weapon stockpiles. And the 2% relates to the total U.S. stockpile, which at the time of entry into the chemical weapons convention was stored at multiple locations. Only two locations remain in the United States where chemical weapons are stored, the one being here at Bluegrass Army Depot, the other at Pueblo Chemical Depot in Colorado.
Has the U.S. ever used chemical weapons in warfare?
No. They were developed. They were readied to be utilized, but largely they served more of a deterrent purpose than anything else.
And so, since they were never used and they were built, I guess, in large quantities, they had to be stored, they had to be kept someplace. Why Kentucky? Why this area?
Well, they were, again, many years ago, the stockpiles were stored at multiple locations. Some of that was to obviously to respond to maximize security, not to have all of the nation stockpile in one location. And then also a lot of the storage locations were strategically picked to be near areas where they could be transported quickly, either by principally by rail at the time, should they need to be moved from the continental United States to potentially outside the United States.
When was it determined that these chemical weapons were going to be destroyed, and how did that all come about? Am I correct that this chemical weapons convention, is this an international agreement among nations that we're just, no one's going to use chemical weapons?
It is an international treaty and an international commitment, again, by 190 nations. That treaty was ratified by the United States Senate in 1997. About 10 years prior to that, however, congressional action here in the United States started the process of declaring the entire stockpile as obsolete and beginning the efforts to begin destruction of the stockpile. There was a document called the Programmatic Environmental Impact Statement. That was one of the first documents that looked at the overall destruction of the stockpile. Again, at that time, there were 9 total sites where chemical weapons were stored.
Doug Omachinsky, your job is to destroy these chemical weapons. How is that done, and tell us how it can be done safely? Obviously, some scary stuff there. When we hear of terrorism and potential threats around the world, sarin is one of those things that's mentioned. Mustard gas, I understand, is not a very friendly agent as well.
Well, just to step back, Jeff mentioned that we're destroying 2% of the stockpile. Up to this point, the other baseline sites have lended, you know, the knowledge and the technology to where we're at here at the Bluegrass site. So we've been able to leverage some of that first-of-a-kind technology that does destroy the weapons. And in this case, neutralize the agent that's within the weapons through various processes that have already been tested. As an integrated system, that's probably our biggest challenge, is integrating all the equipment to work together through one common control scheme.
But it's a facility in which I imagine these weapons have to be opened up to get to the agents, and then what, other chemicals are added to neutralize what's in there?
Correct. Once the chemicals are delivered to us from the Army Depot and then loaded in through to our various equipment, that's the last of the human contact with the equipment or with the weapons. Then we use a series of robotic disassembly equipment to take apart the munitions. That includes draining of the agent and then through a chemical process neutralizing the agent. And then the neutralized portion of that agent is then also treated to make the byproduct basically nothing.
The plant, the $1.8 billion plant, obviously to house this this effort. Why so long? Why so much money to get this underway? And why is it not until 2020 that the destruction is actually going to begin?
The plant itself and the design of the facility, the various the way that these projects develop are in phases, and through tasks that are awarded to the systems contractor from the government. So we developed the design through a design task. We've moved into the construction phase, which also is the final design, and then construction and completion of the facility. That over time is also funding driven by the government. So we have a funding profile that we work to over time. And that drives the time. Once we move into the testing, as you can imagine, testing of first-of-a-kind equipment is very complex. It's time-consuming. We have a lot of demonstration that we have to do with our various stakeholders, either in the community or at the state level or at the federal level. So it's a complex process. It does take time, but it ensures that we're doing it correctly and that we've met the intent of the mission.
Who are the workers out there? Are they members of the local community who've been hired to do this work?
Currently, we're at about 50% local hire in the community. Right now, during the construction phase, we have a combination of craft workers that can range from your laborers, your carpenters, your iron workers, your pipe fitters, your electricians. But we're also now in a phase where we're starting to test the equipment. So we do have systemization workers or test engineers that are working on some of this equipment to make sure that it's working. So you've got a construction completion effort going, as well as the initial phases of testing occurring.
This is Eastern Standard, and we're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about the community and its role and how the community is involved in this process of destroying chemical weapons. We are interested in your questions, your comments, your stories. Please feel free to go ahead and give us a call at 800-621-8890. Get on the line with your question. Certainly, if you're in Madison County or this region, you may have a question about what is happening out there and this whole process and the safety issues. And we will address the safety issues as well during today's program. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at wekuest, and feel free to send us a direct message or post on the Facebook page. That email address again, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Give us a call at 800-621-8890. Chemical weapons, the Bluegrass Army Depot, and the current activities. And actually, there was something announced recently that is going to be happening during the next week, a meeting that's going to happen next week. We'll talk about that as well. 800-621-8890.
It's 11:19. Eastern Standard continues until noon on 88.9 WEKU. We invite listeners to be a part of the show, to call in with your comments. The phone number is 800-621-8890. That's 800-621-8890.
WEKU is supported by the Gates Auto Family Dealerships, Audi of Lexington, Capital Nissan in Frankfort, and Gates Hyundai, Gates Nissan, and Toyota South on the Eastern Bypass in Richmond. Information at GatesAutoFamily.com.
On the next State of the Reunion, we meet a wounded soldier who overcame incredible obstacles. He was finally ready for a fresh start.
This is my calling. After years of 30 years of not knowing, it's like, all right, this is what I need to do. And they looked at me and they laughed. I knew right then that I was never going to get help from them.
Pushing back on the door that's just been slammed in your face. That's on the next State of the Reunion.
Tomorrow evening at 7 on 88.9 WEKU.
It's Eastern Standard on WEKU. 800-621-8890 is our phone number. Chemical weapons, the Bluegrass Army Depot, our topic on today's program. And with us, we have Craig Williams, who is the co-chair of the Chemical Destruction Community Advisory Board, Jeff Brubaker, who is the Assembled Chemical Weapons Alternative Site Manager, and Doug Omachinsky, Bechtel Parsons Bluegrass Project Manager. Bechtel Parsons is a contractor. Hired by the federal government to destroy the weapons at the Bluegrass Army Depot. Again, we will talk safety and Madison County with Michael Bryant of the Madison County EMA in just a few moments. But Jeff, we decided to do this program because we discovered that there was a public hearing, an event occurring, I guess it is next week, April 14th, Monday, and thought, gee, what's going on and why a need for a public meeting?
Yes. Next Monday evening at 7 o'clock, the public meeting will actually be at the EKU Perkins building.
In the very building of our radio station. Yeah.
Just up the elevator, one floor. And the purpose of the meeting is in response to a what's known as a Class 3 permit modification that the project submitted approximately a month ago to the Kentucky Department of Environmental Protection. That permit application is seeking to add a supplemental process to assist in destruction of the overall stockpile, but specifically the system is referred to be a static detonation chamber. That is a type of an explosive destruction technology, a commercially available system that will assist with the destruction of the mustard artillery projectiles at Bluegrass Army Depot. We have determined through extensive sampling and X-ray analysis that the mustard projectiles, given their some 70 years of storage at Bluegrass Army Depot, during that period, the consistency of the agent has actually transitioned from a liquid form, which is how the agent was at time of filling into the munitions back in the early 1940s, and over time it has gelled or solidified to the point that we don't believe that the pumping and extraction equipment in the main plant will be able to effectively remove the equipment. So we can use an explosive chamber to process up to two munitions at a time. The system uses high heat, operates at over 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit, causing the explosive in the munition to detonate. And the combination of that detonation and high heat ensures destruction of the chemical agent.
And so you bring it to the community. Why? Why is that? Has every step of this process involved community involvement of this type?
That's correct. Starting back when the project, the Aqua Program, was formed back in 1996, up through the present and continuing through the end of the project, there has been a continual dialogue with the public. Everything that we do in the plant associated with destruction of the chemical weapons is regulated by a permit that's issued by the state of Kentucky. Up to this point in time, the permits that have been approved have focused on the basic neutralization destruction technology. So this incorporation of explosive destruction is requiring now the addition of supplemental permit approval, and this meeting next Monday is part of the overall initial 60-day public comment period. It allows the community members to come out, hear firsthand from members of the project, the scope of the what's planned, some of the specific technical details, and then for them to ask questions, and if they have any specific comments or concerns, they can also formally provide those next Monday.
Okay. And we're interested in your specific comments, concerns, questions during this program as well. 800-621-8890. Send an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Let's turn to Craig Williams. And Craig, as co-chair of the Chemical Destruction Community Advisory Board, a community group, what is your role? What is the role of the group?
Well, the Citizens Advisory Board is a subset of the governor's appointed Citizens Advisory Commission. A federal statute directed that all the stockpile sites have a advisory commission established by the governor to interact with the Army and the contractor. That was federally mandated to have 9 people. 7 citizens and 2 members from a state agency associated with the project. Once this project got underway here formally, when Bechtel-Parsons got the contract, and AQUA was beginning to execute, the Citizens Advisory Commission felt that it needed a more diverse and a larger number of people to really represent the community more adequately. So what we formed was a subgroup called an advisory board, which now consists of about 28 representatives, everything from educational institutions to environmentalists to citizen members, government officials from both the county and both cities, emergency preparedness people, the Ministerial Association, the NAACP. It's a very diverse and very representative group of people. And what it does is it interacts firsthand, as Jeff pointed out, the transparency and the working together that is associated with this project is quite unique. It didn't start out that way back in the early 80s. There was a lot of controversy about which way to do this and who was getting an ability to participate in the decision-making and so on. That's all history now, and the working relationship we have now is quite remarkable, quite unique. And the Citizens Advisory Board is basically the point of the spear, if you will, for that citizen interaction with both the contractor and with the government side.
Do you and your group trust the federal government and the contractor to pull off this project in a safe manner?
Yes. Now, if you ask me holistically, do we trust the government, that's a different question. but in this particular case, we've established a very high confidence, both in the technology itself, which was primarily the main controversy back in the 80s, was how do you go about doing this safely. But the relationship we built and the transparency that the two agencies that are at the table here now have shown, and the interaction has been tremendous. We have several working groups within the advisory board that deal with things like the explosive detonation technology that Jeff mentioned, secondary waste, permitting issues, economic development, and all sorts of different facets associated with this project. And so we're intimately involved. They're very forthcoming. This public meeting that's coming up is another example of going an extra yard to try to make sure that citizens understand what's happening.
This is Eastern Standard. We have phone lines open, 800-621-8890. If you have a question about chemical weapons and the Bluegrass Army Depot, send us an email to wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send us a tweet at WEKUEST or give us a call, 800-621-8890. Gentlemen, what could go wrong? Is it possible that something could go wrong that would endanger public safety?
I think that is incredibly unlikely, but that is something, that question is something that really has driven the design efforts that are now being incorporated in the construction and ultimately will be proven out during the systemization startup activities before we begin operations. But this facility has many, many systems in place. I call it layers of defense mechanisms to ensure that agent is not released from the processing area. As an example, we have a what we refer to as our cascading ventilation system. That is the system that moves the air through the facility. It brings air from outside the facility and moves the air from clean areas of the plant into progressively more and more potentially contaminated areas. All of the air is collected and transferred and processed through a series of carbon filters. Those filters have charcoal installed, specially designed to pull any agent out of the air and trap the agent on the carbon prior to release. All through that ventilation system, there is a continuous air monitoring that is performed. Those air monitors are looking for extremely low, low levels of chemical agent. Those detectors are located within the filter assemblies as well as on the stack. If at any time there's a detection of chemical agent, we will take immediate action We can take, for instance, we can take a filter. If it's indicating potential agent breakthrough at one of the first of six filter beds, we can take that filter completely offline and replace it with another filter and continue operations, all ensuring that no agent is released back to the environment.
800-621-8890 is our number. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Okay, so for all practical purposes, we expect this process of destruction of the chemical weapons to be a safe process. $1.8 billion is the construction costs for this pilot plant. Am I correct that this, and that ultimately, though, the project is costing, what, three times that?
The overall cost projection from start to finish is $5.4 billion. That includes everything soup to nuts for the whole project: design, engineers, construction, systemization, operations, and closure.
And this is labeled a pilot plant. Does that mean that this is essentially, you know, the beginning of something that goes to the next phase?
Well, the term pilot really goes back to one of the considerations that Doug talked to earlier, and that is with the integration of all of the steps associated with the destruction process. Again, many elements of the destruction process, including the core chemical neutralization process, have been successfully demonstrated and utilized at other sites in the United States to destroy now, you know, several hundred or several thousand tons of chemical agent. One of the challenges at Bluegrass is the fact that the chemical agents are stored in munitions. Many of those munitions have explosive components. We have to separate both components from the weapons, and then there are separate neutralization processes, one for the agent, one for the energetic or explosive components. And then finally, after those waste products are safely collected and secured, they are then processed in another process, the supercritical water oxidation process, that basically takes the heavily corrosive and organic nutrient product and reduces it down to water and salts. The salts are collected for landfill disposal. The water is collected and processed through a water recovery system, and we can recycle about 70 to 75% of the water back into the process.
Okay, this actual destruction begins in 2020, is finished in 2023. Now, what happens to the $5.4 billion facility?
Well, within the advisory board, there's a working group that's called the Economic Development Working Group. And we're partnered with a number of agencies and entities throughout the state and locally to look at that very question. We anticipate that there will be a significant amount of the infrastructure will remain. The only piece that we believe would possibly be torn down would be the actual processing building itself. But there are a number of ancillary buildings and infrastructure that will be of significant value, as well as a workforce of highly trained individuals. Now, a lot of those folks work for Bechtel, and they'll be reassigned elsewhere, but many of them are local people who have been trained and so on, engineers, computer experts, robotics people, those sorts of things. And we're doing a study right now, a three-phase study, to look at both of those questions. How do we capitalize on the infrastructure once the weapons are disposed of and the area is decontaminated? And by the area, I mean the building specifically where the agents were processed. And how do we maintain or keep the workforce here in Madison County? It's a three-phase study. The first phase has been completed. The next two phases are looking for funding to be complete. And at the end of the day, and well before the termination of the project, we anticipate having a business plan in place that will take advantage of those assets, both the infrastructural assets and the human assets associated with the project.
Will that property out there be considered the equivalent of a brownfield? Is it a contaminated
No.
area? So it could, you could build a daycare on the site when this is all over?
That's possible, although with the infrastructure that's there, I don't think a daycare would be an appropriate use. But ideally, what we'd like to see, and it depends on the ownership of the property, which will still be federally owned, and it depends on a lot of different congressional and federal laws and statutes and state regulations, but it can go either way. The facility could be transferred over to the depot proper as part of its conventional weapons mission, which would give it a tremendous asset and perhaps help it stay functional for a longer period of time.
Are there conventional weapons out there?
Oh, yeah. That's their primary mission. This chemical weapons piece, they're merely a tenant on the depot whose primary mission is associated with conventional weapons. This infrastructure could be an asset to them, so it would be increase the depot's mission capacity, or it could be transferred over to the private sector, where perhaps one of the Bechtel Parsons subcontractors who are involved in this project may want to locate here. They'll have a trained workforce. They'll have an extraordinary opportunity because of the infrastructure that's already there. All the utilities are there and so forth. So we're going to have a plan to look at it in both directions well before the processing is over so that we can have some sort of vision as to how to best capitalize on this and make it a real asset for the community in the longer term.
Doug Omachinsky, how many employees do you have out there right now at the Bluegrass Army Depot?
We're at about 1,350. About half of that, close to 700, are associated with the construction craft.
As the project moves forward, I know we're going to be letting you go here in a few moments. Will there be opportunities for employment for others?
Oh, yes. Yes. As we move through the construction phase, the construction workers will have finished their mission and move on to their next projects, and then we'll start to employ the remaining employees for systemization, and then we'll move into employing operators to operate the plant.
Well, Doug Omachinsky, thank you for being with us. Doug is Bechtel Parsons Bluegrass Project Manager. He'll still be here in the studio as we ask listeners to get involved in the conversation, but we are in a moment we're going to bring in Michael Bryant from the Madison County EMA. Doug, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
It's Eastern Standard. Our phone number, 800-621-8890. Do you have a question about the chemical weapons stored at the Bluegrass Army Depot? What about this process of destroying the chemical weapons? Are you comfortable with what is going on out there and the fact that it has been in this community? For listeners in Madison County and surrounding communities, we're interested in your questions, your comments, your personal stories. Know somebody who worked out there. Know somebody who was out there in the 1940s when this all began. 800-621-8890, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send us a tweet at WEKU EST. It's 800-621-8890. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Chemical weapons, the Bluegrass Army Depot, our topic on this morning's program, 800-621-8890. With us in the studio still, Craig Williams, co-chair of the Chemical Destruction Community Advisory Board, and Jeff Brubaker, Assembled Chemical Weapons Alternatives Site Manager. And joining us now is Michael Bryant, CSEP Director, Chemical Stockpile Emergency Preparedness Program, Director for the Madison County Emergency Management Agency. Michael, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me here.
Talk about the history of your agency. I guess your agency is in place really to deal with all kinds of potential emergencies in the community. When there's a tornado warning, you tell us about it. And I know you use facilities of local broadcasters such as ours to get those messages out there. Chemical weapons, that's something unique to this community, right?
Absolutely. I tell folks it's a good news, bad news sort of thing. Is, you know, we have the chemical weapons here, but due to that fact, we have some funding. We have a lot of tools that a lot of folks don't have in Madison County and elsewhere. We're an all-hazards organization. You know, our primary mission is going to be if something, in the unlikely event that something happens at the Bluegrass Army Depot, we're going to be involved in that. We're going to respond to that. But we're an all-hazards. We're going to respond to severe weather. We're going to respond to hazmats at a railroad track, a local factory, or even respond to an event on the interstate.
So in terms of the Army Depot and the chemical weapons out there, if there were some kind of emergency, and as a matter of fact, I'm a relatively new member of the community, been here a little more than 2 years. When I came in, I noticed, gosh, the calendar that arrived at my place had information about zones and what to do of course, all the normal warnings about tornadoes and things of that nature. But in terms of there were chemical weapons or there were chemical issues in the community. When you drive around the community, you'll see zones marked on signs around the area. Is that common in Kentucky counties, or is this something specific to
this
Madison?
This is something specific to Madison County. Madison County is divided up into 13 zones, and we try to tell folks the zone you live in is going to determine what kind of actions you're going to take. We work very closely with Bluegrass Army Depot. We've got a program that if the unlikely event they have a release, we know exactly where that chemical plume is going to go. We know what time it's going to reach your neighborhood and what time it's going to leave the neighborhood. For an example, if it heads north, one of the zones is 1 alpha, 1A. And the actions that most folks are going to take for a chemical event is going to be shelter in place. It's not going to be evacuation. Shelter in place, very simple concept. You want to keep the bad air out and the good air in. The duct tape and plastic, a lot of folks have heard about. If you live in a zone called that starts with a 1 or a 2, that's what we call the immediate response zone. That's immediately surrounding the depot. If you live in a zone that's a 3, that's a protective action zone. You may or may not have to do something in that zone.
How wide is the area of protection or concern about the Army depot? How far beyond, I guess, in a mileage point of view, is there a concern?
The immediate response zone is roughly 6.2 miles from where the chemicals are actually located. It's a radius of 6.2 miles, and that's what we did our immediate response zone. The surrounding counties play a part in the CSEP program to the point of Fayette County. They may receive, if we relocate folks, they may be going to Fayette County, may be going to Powell County or some of the other counties. But the initial, when they first started the program here in the late 80s, they did some scientific studies, and they said, you know, in the unlikely event something does happen, chances are it's going to impact in that 6.2 mile radius.
This is Eastern Standard, and we're interested in your questions regarding the Bluegrass Army Depot and chemical weapons. 800-621-8890 is our number. We do have people waiting on the line, so let's talk to Carrie from Nicholasville. Carrie, thank you for your call. Go right ahead.
I'm worried with the kind of investment they have out there that Richmond, Kentucky is going to become the hazardous waste capital of destruction capital of central U.S. I wondered if they'd speak to that issue.
All right. And Craig Williams is a co-chair of the Chemical Destruction Community Advisory Board.
Well, there's several aspects to answer that question. First of all, there are a number of federal laws that prohibit any importation to Kentucky of any additional chemical warfare materials, whether they be in weapons or whether they be in bulk storage. None of that is allowed to come into the area. Secondly, the technology that's being deployed there, with the exception of the explosive destruction technology, which would be a great asset to the depot itself and their conventional weapons, is not really appropriate for long-term, large quantities of hazardous waste treatment, reception, or destruction. It's just not that sort of operation. And, of course, there is permitting issues associated with anything that it might want to be used for in the future that may be associated with hazardous waste. For example, if they continue to use it for conventional weapons, there's permits that have to be acquired by the state of Kentucky and the EPA in order to use that facility for that purpose. In addition, and I think the final and most important aspect of this is that the community involvement in what might transpire there after the chemical weapons are gone is going to play a critical role in its future. And I would be willing to say that the vast majority of people would not want to see it turn into a hazardous waste reception point.
800-621-8890. Let's talk to Nicholas from Pike County. Nicholas, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Yes, I was calling about, you know, all the jobs that they said it's going to bring there. And I was wondering if them was jobs that you could get with just a high school diploma, or would you have to have a college degree to get them? And how do you go about applying for a job now?
Jeff.
Okay. Great. That's a great question. As the project continues, we will be hiring additional folks. There will be many opportunities for employment. Our project does recruiting locally to support that hiring. And the types of jobs and the educational and skill sets do vary depending on the type of position that's going to be utilized. Some of the jobs, many of the jobs, may require either a college degree and or technical education. There are some other jobs where a high school education may be sufficient. Those would be perhaps more in the plant operations area. The best way to learn about opportunities is to visit the project website, and that's where all of the job postings are listed.
Okay, thank you for that call. That was Nicholas from Pike County. We had a call from Philip from Berea who passed along a question. He says, if there are chemical weapons at the Army depot, in light of 9/11, why are commercial aircraft allowed to fly in the depot's airspace?
Well, I'll tell you, immediately following 9/11, the airspace was restricted. And now they're allowed to now fly over it, but it's a very it's observed very carefully what kinds of aircraft are there, and if it's anything that's off normal, anything that is not in a flight plan that has been okayed and approved, then there are how shall I say, capabilities to react to that situation.
So this is an area where if something weird were going on, what the Air Force and the armed forces in general would be prepared to respond?
Yes, I would say it's not a place that you'd want to fly over for scenic photographing and things of that nature, because it would arouse some suspicions.
Is there any restriction on non-commercial air traffic?
No, not
private
at the moment.
There,
like I said, for several years, in fact, after 9/11, there was strict restrictions in the airspace there. But now, like a lot of other things, things have mellowed out a little bit, and there's not. But again, if there's anything that's seen as unusual by the spotters on the ground or air traffic controllers, radar folks, and flight plan people, then a reaction is taken immediately.
For those of you, both Craig and Michael, representing the community and safety matters, is Madison County maybe even a safer place than some other communities because of the location of the Army Depot?
I think so. One of the things, I know there is only one community in the entire state that has more outdoor sirens than we do, and that's Louisville. We have 90 outdoor sirens. We provided about 15,000 emergency radios to the community. That's provided to them for absolutely free. We've upgraded a lot of the equipment for police, fire, rescue. We work very closely with those folks. And one of the things we do here in Madison County, we average about 30-plus training exercises a year. One of the things we're doing tonight is a decon exercise. And that just makes us better prepared to handle an event at the depot, to handle any kind of event.
There's no question in my mind, and I think everyone that works is associated with the program in any aspect agrees that we are light years ahead of in emergency preparedness at every level from any place, probably in the country, surely in the state, because of Mike's agency. Now, it's also important for folks to understand that the overwhelming majority, if not 100% of the funding that's associated with all of these upgrades is not coming from county taxes, not coming from the state. It's a federal program that's been instituted because of the chemical weapons. There is an issue, of course, as to how do you maintain all of this infrastructure and this capability once the chemical weapons are gone. That's already being looked at and already being worked on, but we're You can't find a more responsible group of folks, and the assets that they have are phenomenal. So I think we're very fortunate to have that going on in association with this other task, which is the bad news part, but we're working on that as well.
Jeff Brubaker, representing the federal government, what's the status of funding? Is it possible that, you know, with all the wrangling that's gone on these last number of years over federal budgets, is the money absolutely assured to complete this project and to keep it safe?
Well, we feel very confident that the funding necessary will be provided. However, having said that, we are a federal agency, which means each year we need to identify what our budget requirements are going to be. Those get rolled up into what's called the Department of Defense's budget, which is part of the President's budget, which then goes to Capitol Hill for evaluation. But I can tell you over the last 4 to 5 years, Congress has been very supportive. There are key congressional leaders from both Kentucky and Pueblo, Colorado that are very interested in this these two projects moving forward and completing safe destruction of the stockpiles. And I think Craig's going to want to add something here.
Well, yeah, I do. We've had a number of battles over finances for the entire life of this project. We have been fortunate in the last several years to have a steady stream of funding, which doesn't guarantee next year. In Congress, as most people know, every year is a new adventure. And so we have to remain vigilant. We work very closely with Capitol Hill, the Pentagon, and the Congressional Budget Office, the Comptroller's Office, and others associated with the budget, and the White House as well, to try and ensure that the funding maintains a steady flow. I think we've finally made the impression down there that this project has to go forward, not only for the safety of the community, but because of our international treaty obligations. So we remain vigilant. We remain involved. There have been a number of times where we, along with our colleagues down in Washington, have had to step up in a heavy-handed way to maintain the funding, but we've been able to do that.
Let's go back to the phones and talk to Charles from Lexington. Charles, thank you for calling and for being patient with us. Go right ahead.
Okay, this is I'm a graduate of the Eastern Construction Technology Program, and what I wonder is why you all don't put the inflatable covers over top of each one of these igloos like you see on a tennis court in the wintertime, and then you've got any leaks contained, and you've got sensors right in there.
And these igloos are one of the features out there at the site.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, I know there's a bunch of them. My grandfather's company actually put the chain link fence 28 miles around the depot back in the 40s or 50s.
Yes, the igloos are the structures in which the chemical weapons are safely maintained. The Bluegrass Chemical Activity has that responsibility for safe storage of the munitions until the destruction facility comes online and they begin to transfer the munitions over to the facility. Essentially, the depot and the chemical activity have a very robust program where the igloos are tested through air monitoring. Many of the igloos, particularly the igloos that are containing the GB nerve agent, because it is the most volatile by far of the three agents. There are requirements for at least weekly verifications inside the igloos to ensure that there has been no release of agent. If there were to be a detection, they would immediately install a filtration system on the igloo, which would ensure that any agent is captured again on the carbon and not released to the environment.
So as Charles was suggesting, that no need for an inflatable outer cover of the type that he's suggesting.
Yeah, the risk is already very low, so that would not be something that would be required.
All right, well, we have just a couple of minutes remaining in today's program. First up, Michael Bryant with Madison County EMA. Let's talk about, again, the warning system and the safety procedures in place in Madison County. I mean, a lot of places, you know, the tornado alarms go off, the sirens go off, and people go, oh, well, there's another one of those. Would you recommend maybe heightened alertness in Madison County over such alarms when they go off?
Oh, absolutely. You know, a lot of folks say we sound them too often. Our criteria is going to be for a severe thunderstorm warning or a tornado warning. The National Weather Service, their definition of a severe thunderstorm warning, have winds up to 60, 65 miles an hour, nickel-sized hail that could turn into a tornado. So they should take that siren warning very seriously.
If there were a chemical leak, what would the warning sound different? Would we hear announcements? Would we know what was going on?
It's a completely different sound. It sort of sounds like a European police car. It's a high-low, steady well is what they call it.
That's never tested, is it? Or is it?
No, that's never tested. We do a test. Westminster Chimes, the first Saturday and third Wednesday of every month at 12:20, strictly a test.
Okay, and Jeff Brubaker with the Assembled Chemical Weapons Alternatives Site Manager. Jeff, the meeting again Monday evening, the 14th. Very briefly, the details, timing, and location.
Yes, the meeting will start at 7 p.m. at EKU Perkins Building. And the meeting is to solicit any questions or comments from the public regarding a permit application that's being sought to add an explosive destruction technology system to aid in the destruction of the mustard munitions.
Craig Williams, representing the community, is your group looking for input from the public?
Oh, yeah, we're always open for input. You can find information on who's on the commission and who's on the advisory board on the website, the AQUA website. And we have quarterly meetings that are announced both in television and on the radio and in the newspaper. And the public is more than welcome to come. And we usually get a pretty good turnout of interested people and a lot of good questions.
All righty. Well, that's it for this week's Eastern Standard. This program will be available for listening on the website as well as a podcast. We want to thank our guests, Craig Williams, Jeff Brubaker, Doug Omachinsky, who was with us earlier in the program, and Michael Bryant. And we also thank our crew, our producers. This program today was put together by Andrew Moorhead with assistance from Logan Riley and Richard Turner. Julie Tennell is on the phone. It's Joni Franklin at the controls. For WEKU, I'm John Hingsbergen.